For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Without a doubt and without exaggeration, this is the most important event that's ever happened in human history, the cross. And really, all of the Gospels are pointing in this direction. As we mentioned, the book of John itself, the last third, or maybe even more than that, is comprised of the events surrounding the cross, the last 24 hours of Jesus' life. Let's begin in verse 1, chapter 19. Then Pilate took Jesus and had him flogged. The soldiers twisted together a crown of thorns and put it onto his head. So the first thing that we're told in John's account is that after Jesus' trial before Pilate, that Pilate took Jesus and had him flogged. Now, it's interesting because in 1986, the Journal of American Medical Association actually did a study on the crucifixion of Jesus and the known medical effects that it had on its victims. Here's an excerpt from the article. It says, as the Roman soldiers repeatedly struck the victim's back with full force, the iron balls would cause deep contusions, and the leather thongs and sheep bone would cut into the skin and subcutaneous tissues. This whip that they used was not a regular whip. On the end of this whip called the flagellum, which had five or six different leather thongs associated with it or attached to it, there would be little pieces of bone, pieces of lead, and as the victim would be laying on the stump, the executioner, the flogger, would hit the victim in the back, and many of these pieces would stick into the victim's back, and they would rip out large sections of flesh in the victim's back. They go on to say, then as the flogging continued, the lacerations would tear into the underlying skeletal muscles and produce quivering ribbons of bleeding flesh. In some cases, their rib cages were exposed from behind and even their organs. Pain and blood loss generally set the stage for circulatory shock. The extent of blood loss may well have determined how long the victim would survive on the cross. In fact, many times the victim would actually die as soon as the flogging was over. And that was actually viewed as being somewhat merciful, considering the excruciating pain that would come about through the cross. Well, we're told that the soldiers twisted together this crown of thorns, put it on his head, and they clothed him in a purple robe to mock him. Purple at that time was a very difficult color to harvest, and it was typically used for royalty. This might have been Pilate's own robe that was given to Jesus as a way to mock the Jews. Verse 3, and they went up to him again and again saying, Hail, King of the Jews, and they struck him in the face. Matthew adds some more details in his account. Matthew 27, verse 30 tells us that they spit on him and took the staff and struck him on the head again and again. And so they humiliated Jesus, they struck him in the face, they spit on him, mocked him in front of people. Once more, Pilate came out and said to the Jews, Look, I'm bringing him out to you to let you know that I find no basis for a charge against him. Remember, Pilate did not want to crucify Jesus, and he thought that if he flogged Jesus, that maybe the crowds would be satisfied. Well, when Jesus came out wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe, Pilate said to them, Here is the man. As soon as the chief priests and the officials saw him, they shouted even more, Crucify! Crucify! But Pilate answered, You take him and crucify him. As for me, I find no basis for a charge against him. And so Pilate, of course, knew that the Jews were unable to crucify people, that that was actually what the Romans, only the Romans could do that. They were the ones who were authorized to do it, but Pilate was resentful toward the Jews. We know that in history that he had a long history of antisemitism and that he reveled in the opportunities that he had actually to harm the Jews and to persecute them. The Jews, of course, insisted, "We have a law, and according to that law, he must die because he claimed to be the Son of God." And when Pilate heard this, he was even more afraid. Now, this seems a little bit strange. Why would Pilate be afraid? Well, we know that Pilate was very superstitious, that in the Roman world, the Roman emperors were oftentimes viewed as king-like or deity-like figures, god-like figures. And so Pilate probably was very superstitious and was worried that maybe this Jesus represented some sort of god-like figure. Not to mention he had just flogged this guy. We're told in a parallel account, Matthew 27, verse 19, that while Pilate was sitting on the judge's seat, his wife sent him a message saying, "Don't have anything to do with that innocent man, for I've suffered a great deal today in a dream because of him." So that corroborates the theory that the reason why Pilate was afraid was because he was a superstitious person. His wife also had a dream about this Jesus and sent him a personal note about it, warning him. Verse 9, he went back inside the palace. And Pilate asked, "Where do you come from?" But Jesus gave him no answer. "Do you refuse to speak to me?" Pilate said. "Do you realize that I have power either to free you or to crucify you?" Jesus answered, "You would have no power over me if it were not given to you from above. Therefore, the one who handed me over to you is guilty of greater sin." Jesus says that the person who handed him over to his authority was actually more guilty. Now, we're not entirely sure if it was Caiaphas, who was sort of the acting high priest at the time, or if it was Judas. It's not really clear. Either way, Jesus is indicating that those guys, one of those guys, is more responsible than even Pilate. And yet, he's not letting Pilate off the hook here either. By implication, he's saying that these guys have greater guilt, which implies that he is guilty as well. Make no mistake, Pilate was just as guilty in a lot of ways as these people who brought him before the Romans to be crucified. Well, we're told in verse 12, from then on, Pilate tried to set Jesus free, but the Jews kept shouting, "If you let this man go, you are no friend of Caesar. Anyone who claims to be a king opposes Caesar." One of the things that historians, particularly critical scholars of the Bible, say about these accounts that are given in the Gospels about Pilate is that we know that Pilate was this vicious anti-Semite, and that he took every opportunity that he could to persecute the Jews. And yet in the gospel accounts, we find that Pilate is often depicted as being afraid, cowering. And eventually we know that the Jews actually had their way with Pilate and that they eventually were able to get Jesus crucified. And so what critical scholars have to say then is that this account is fabricated because it doesn't line up with what we know about Pilate in history. And yet, it's very interesting when you consider the background behind this. When you look at the political climate in Rome at the time, we know that Tiberius, who in 26 AD decided to retire to the island of Capri, and we know that he was out there having drinking parties, eating as much as he could, being a glutton, and he was having all these different sex orgies. And meanwhile, what he did was he had his commander of the Praetorian Guard, Sejanus, run the entire Roman Empire. And at one point, Sejanus decided that he was going to usurp the throne. So he started putting some officials and appointing them in different prominent parts or areas of the Roman Empire. And when Tiberius found out that Sejanus was plotting to usurp him, he ordered the Senate to execute Sejanus. And that happened in 31 AD. Now, interestingly, one of the people that Sejanus appointed was actually Pontius Pilate. And so that makes sense. You know, it shows, I think there's some corroboration here where The Jewish crowds are putting pressure onto Pilate to crucify Jesus, and it seems like he's backing away. He's afraid of them. Not to mention, he says, if you let this man go, you are no friend of Caesar's. In other words, we can make sure that the speculation that you were one of the usurpers, that people will probably be able to testify about that. They were pressuring him. And so it makes sense that he would act the way that he did. Verse 13, when Pilate heard this, he brought Jesus out, sat down on the judge's seat at a place known as the stone pavement, which in Aramaic is called Gabbatha. It was the day of preparation of Passover week, about the sixth hour. "Here is your king," Pilate said to the Jews, mocking them. But they shouted, "Take him away, take him away, crucify him." "Shall I crucify your king?" Pilate asked. You could sense the hatred that Pilate has for the Jews. Any opportunity he can get, he wants to mock them. "We have no king but Caesar," the chief priests answered. Finally, Pilate handed him over to be crucified, and so the soldiers took charge of Jesus. You know, we're told in Matthew 27, verse 24, that when Pilate saw that he was getting nowhere, but instead an uproar was starting, he took water and washed his hands in front of the crowd, which is where we get the saying, "I wash my hands of this." He says, "I'm innocent of this man's blood." He said, "It's your responsibility now." Little did Pilate know that sin doesn't work that way, where you can simply wash it away with soapy water. But it was actually the blood of the man he was about to crucify that would be able to wash away his sins, and yet he didn't realize that. The other thing that's a little bit ironic here, too, is that Pilate thought he was in the position of power, when in fact Jesus was the one who was in the position of power. Knowing that the Father had authority over him and that he was allowing this to happen. Jesus wasn't some pathetic victim, some pathetic martyr who just died based on circumstances that were out of his control. Jesus knew full well going into this that this is what his mission was. I like the way that James Stocker puts it in his book. He says, "In the silence of this interior hall, he and Pilate stood face to face. He in the lonely prisoner's place, Pilate in the place of power. Yet how strangely, as we look back at that scene, are the places reversed. It's Pilate who's going to be tried. All that morning, Pilate is being judged and exposed. And ever since, he stood in the stocks of history with the centuries gazing at him." Far from Jesus being on trial for his innocence, Pilate was on trial for his guilt, his culpability in this. Verse 17, carrying his own cross, he went out to the place of the skull, which is known in Aramaic as Golgotha. This place, Golgotha, was located outside of the gates of the city of Jerusalem. And most people think that Golgotha was a major intersection, a highway, right outside the city of Jerusalem. And it was intentional that they crucified Jesus right there because they wanted to make sure that bystanders who were walking by would recognize and see this horrific scene of people being crucified. It was a way of the Roman Empire really saying to the people passing by, "This is what happens when you mess with Rome." It was a warning. It was meant to be a deterrent. Verse 18, "Here they crucified him and with him two others, one on each side and Jesus in the middle." Now, this crucifixion, of course, led to incredible physical agony. And I want to talk a little bit about the physical agony of the cross. You know, the first thing we know is that they were stripped naked. Unlike the depictions that we see in movies or in pictures today, victims of crucifixion were completely naked, and part of that was to humiliate the victim. Not to mention, in a day where in Jewish culture it was very much inappropriate and immodest to be walking around naked, I mean, to see a corpse that was streaked with blood naked on the side of a highway would have been very disturbing. Secondly, we know that victims were made to carry their own cross, where It was about 75 pounds to 125 pounds. The entire cross itself was about 300 pounds. And so it was kind of a psychological thing that the Romans were doing. They were essentially indicating you're a dead man walking. You had to carry your own instrument of death to the place of your execution. Of course, this type of punishment was reserved only for slaves and those guilty of treason. This was not fit for a Roman citizen. If a Roman citizen committed treason or was going to be punished by execution, they would be beheaded because it was considered merciful. We also know that the average time of death that was recorded in history is anywhere between 3 to 4 hours and 3 to 4 days. So these bodies would just be laying out there, half dead, barely alive, as vultures would pick at their body as they were still alive. We know that the crosses, even though they're depicted in the movies as being, you know, about 12 feet tall, were actually about 6 to 8 feet tall. And so dogs, wild dogs, would come up at night and start eating at the bodies of these people who are still alive. And ultimately, the cause of death was usually asphyxiation or heart failure. They would take a 5 to 7 inch nail spike and they would drive it through the wrist. And the Journal of American Medical Association believes that when they drove that spike through the wrist, that it went right through the median nerve. And it would also, they would also drive it through there so that it wouldn't hit any major arteries or break any bones. They would also drive a stake vertically through both feet into the cross, which usually had a little lip that was nailed in it. And so the idea was that as the victim was stretched out, he was incapable of breathing, and so the way that he would be able to breathe was either to lift himself up by the spikes in his hand and alternating by pushing up on the spikes on his feet. And since the victim had been flogged right before that, each time he would breathe, he would have to lift himself up with the wood chafing against his back that was ribbons of flesh at this point. This is what the JAMA article says. The driven nail would crush or sever the rather large sensorimotor median nerve. The stimulated nerve would produce excruciating bolts of fiery pain in both arms. Here's the documentation in the article. As you can see, they drove the spike right through the metatarsal there in the foot, and they would have to push up on that, which would cause incredible pain. Cicero, one of the great speech makers in Rome, says that it was the most cruel and disgusting penalty. In another piece that he wrote, he says, "Let the very name of the cross be far away, not only from the body of a Roman citizen, but even from his thoughts, his eyes, and his ears." So horrific. It was something that you didn't even want to have to talk about in public. Mentheo, the Egyptian poet, says, "Punished with limbs outstretched, they see the stake as their fate. They're fastened and nailed to it in the most bitter torment, evil food for birds of prey, and grim pickings for dogs." Seneca says, "Can anyone be found who would prefer wasting away in pain, dying limb by limb, or letting out his life drop by drop, rather than expiring once for all? Can any man be found willing to be fastened to the accursed tree, long, sickly, already deformed, swelling with ugly wounds on shoulders and chest, and drawing the breath of life amid long, drawn-out agony? He would have many excuses for dying even before mounting the cross." Again, Seneca says, "I see crosses there, not just one of some kind, but many in different ways. Some have their victims with their head down to the ground, some impaled through their private parts, others stretched out their arms on the gibbet." And so they had different ways that they would go about crucifying their victims. Incredible agony that Jesus had to undergo. Of course, Jesus had to undergo incredible psychological agony at the cross as well. You know, the crowds hurled insults at Jesus. Luke 23, verse 35 says, the people stood watching and the rulers even sneered at him. They said, he saved others. Let him save himself if he's the Christ of God, the chosen one. Matthew 27, verse 42 and 43, he saved others, but he can't even save himself. He's the King of Israel. Let him come down from the cross and we'll believe in him. He trusts in God. Let God rescue him. Now if he wants him, for he said, I am the Son of God. Matthew 26, verse 53, Jesus says, do you think that I cannot call on my Father and that he will at once put at my disposal more than 12 legions of angels? You know, unlike most victims, Jesus was capable of doing something about this. At any moment, he could have put a stop to this. Even on the cross, he says that he could call and dispatch 12 legions of angels to come and rescue him. You know, it's one thing if you're a pitiful victim of circumstance where you have no control. But what if you knew you had a way out? And that's exactly the position that Jesus was in. He had a way out, and yet he willingly chose the cross. What about seeing his mother watch in agony as he was being tortured to death? We're told later on, even in his last moments, with the last few breaths that he has, he expends it to tell John the apostle to go and take care of his mother. Can you imagine being a mother watching your son being tortured to death in the most horrific way possible? What about the psychological pain of bearing the guilt for our sin? We get tastes of this. You know, when we fall into sin, we feel that weight of guilt that bears down on us. You know, we feel this bitter sense that we're separated from everything that's right in the world. And yet we're used to sin. We're inundated with it on a daily basis. And yet when you think about what Jesus had to go through, Jesus, being morally perfect, had revulsions, strong revulsions against sin. And yet he willingly took that on himself. He willingly bore the guilt that we deserve to pay for. We're told in verse 19 that Pilate had a notice prepared and fastened it to the cross. It read, Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews. This notice is actually very interesting. It's called the Titulus. And what they did is they would post the crimes against the prisoner. And in Jesus' case, they nailed it right above his head on the cross. The Romans did this because they wanted to make sure that when people passed by, they knew what crime this victim had committed. And I think they wanted to try to communicate, if you ever do this, you're going to have to deal with us. And yet, I think it's ironic, it's very interesting that when you look at the offense that Jesus had posted on his titulus, it was nothing more than Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews, which is quite an understatement for who he is. It should really read, Jesus of Nazareth, King of the World. And there's an irony there because he in fact died because he is the King of the World. He is the King of the Universe. In lesser cases where somebody committed a crime that was punishable by some sort of work, detail, or maybe some sort of imprisonment, they would be given what's called a certificate of debt. And this certificate of debt would list the crime or the offense that was given, as well as the punishment. And you would carry this around. You know, if you were a galley slave or a galley prisoner, you would have that posted right by your seat. Or if you were in a prison cell, it would be posted right next to your cell. And once you paid that off, once you finished your sentence, what the judge would do is he would come over and he would write on there or stamp, paid in full. Paul, thinking about this and probably reflecting on the fact that Jesus had a certificate of debt, in Colossians 2, verse 13 says, he made you alive together with him, having forgiven us all our transgressions, and having canceled out the certificate of debt consisting of decrees against us, which was hostile to us, and has taken it out of the way, having nailed it to the cross. You know, the Bible says that each and every one of us are carrying a certificate of debt. That God, as we live our lives, is compiling this list of things that we've done wrong. Every act of selfishness, every act of betrayal, every opportunity where we could have done something right and we decided that we weren't, it's being added to this certificate of debt. It's pretty intense. You know, some of us might be thinking, well, I'm not that bad. That might be true. It might be true that your certificate of debt is probably smaller than maybe mine or somebody else's. I've got a pretty big certificate of debt. They'd probably have to roll it in here on a truck bed. But the fact is, you have a certificate of debt, and it needs to be paid. You know, sometimes I think that because we compare ourselves to other people who are morally corrupt, we tend to fool ourselves into thinking that we're pretty good. But by comparison, when you think about who you are and what you've done compared to the God of the universe who is morally perfect, there's no comparison. You stand guilty before Him. You know, even when we are looking at the selfishness, the evil, the destruction in the world, it's hard to watch. I was just watching CNN last week and, you know, watching these horrific scenes of the Syrian chemical strikes. I mean, it was just more than I could even handle. You know, you just sit there for about 20 or 30 minutes and your head is just swimming. Your stomach is just unsettled. And at some point you just have to say, you know what? Turn it off. It's so intrusive. Just streaming into your living room. And yet, God doesn't have that luxury. God is omniscient. You know, imagine if you had, you know, billions of monitors in a room. And you had live caption TV on every place on the planet. Every house, every room. And you had to watch every single act of evil, every single act of murder, every act of genocide, every act of rape, every act of selfishness, and there was no way that you could ever turn away from it. That's what God has to experience. He can't turn it off. He's omniscient. And God says, I can't just stand around and do nothing about that. I am the final arbiter of justice in the universe. And really, if God was either unwilling or incapable of punishing evil in the world, what does that say about God and His character? And so, Paul says, something needs to be done about our certificate of debt. Either somebody pays for it, or we have to pay for it ourselves. We're told in verse 20, many of the Jews read this sign, for the place where Jesus was crucified was near the city, and the sign was written in Aramaic, Latin, and Greek. The chief priests of the Jews protested to Pilate, don't write the King of the Jews, but this man claimed to be the King of the Jews. Pilate answered, I've written what I've written. It's kind of a final act of defiance and mockery of the Jews. When the soldiers crucified Jesus, they took his clothes, dividing it among them in four shares, one for each of them, with the undergarment remaining. This garment was seamless, woven in one piece from top to bottom. It's very interesting that there's so much detail about this garment, and yet we know that John, according to his account, was an eyewitness to this event. And so some of these details that are given in the Gospel of John are details of authenticity. Verse 24, let's not tear it, they said to one another. Let's decide by lot who will get it. And this happened that the scripture might be fulfilled, which said, they divided my garments among them and cast lot for my clothing. So this is what the soldiers did. Of course, this is a reference to Psalm 22, verse 18. This incredible psalm that was written by King David way in advance, predicting Jesus' death. Verse 25, near the cross of Jesus stood his mother, his mother's sister Mary, the wife of Clopas, and Mary Magdalene. When Jesus saw his mother there and the disciple whom he loves standing nearby, which is probably a reference to John, he said to his mother, "Dear woman, here is your son." And to the disciple he said, "Here is your mother." From that time on, the disciple took her into his home. We're told in Matthew, in the intervening events between this event right here and Jesus' death on the cross, that he actually experienced the spiritual torment of the cross. In Matthew 27, verse 45 and 46, we're told that from the sixth hour of darkness, there was darkness that fell upon the land until the ninth hour. And I think this is very interesting because this is most likely a reference to the Old Testament. The darkness is a reference to God's judgment. In Amos chapter 8, verse 9 and 10, we're told, "In that day, declares the sovereign Lord, I will make the sun go down at noon and darken the earth in broad daylight. I will turn your religious feasts into mourning and all your singing into weeping." Remember that at this time it was the Passover feast. Amos goes on to say, prophesying for God, "I will make that time like mourning for an only son and the end of it like a bitter day." And so we're told then that this darkness that befell the land was an indication of God's judgment being poured upon Jesus. In verse 45 and 46 of Matthew 27, we're told, "At about the ninth hour, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, saying, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, that is, my God, why have you forsaken me?" Of course, this was a reference, a quotation from the first line of Psalm 22. Back then, they didn't have chapter and verses like we do. And so typically, whenever they would quote a psalm, they would quote the first line, indicating the reference. And so Jesus is quoting Psalm 22 and saying, "Think about that." And of course, most of the people who were standing there were Jews, and probably would have been easy for them to recall Psalm 22. They would have been thinking about the content of that verse, that passage. Let's look at some excerpts from this. Psalm 22, verse 1, 7, and 8. My God, why have you forsaken me? Far from my deliverance are the words of my groaning. All who see me sneer at me. They separate with their lip. They wag their head, saying, commit yourself to the Lord. Let him deliver him. Let him rescue him, because he delights in him. Which is exactly what the guards did. Verse 14 and 15, we're told, I'm poured out like water and all my bones are out of joint. My heart is like wax. It's melted within me. My strength is dried up like a potsherd and my tongue cleaves to my jaws and you lay me in the dust of death. It was typical that whenever a victim of crucifixion would be hanging for any number of hours, that the victim would be very thirsty. They'd be dehydrated in part because of the blood loss. And so the Roman guards would typically feed the victim some water or some wine to try to keep them alive for as long as possible. It wasn't actually benevolent that they did that. They wanted to make sure that the crucifixion would be drawn out as long as possible. All of this predicted 1,000 years before the crucifixion, this incredible event. Of course, we know that even though people didn't realize that this was happening, that Jesus was silently bearing the punishment of the entire human race. We're told in 1 Peter 2, verse 24, he bore in himself our sins on the body, on the tree, and by his wounds you have been healed. The Bible teaches that Jesus came in the likeness of man in order to identify with us. But unlike us, he is perfectly innocent. He's morally perfect. And he had to be that way so that he could be an adequate substitute in our place, so that we didn't have to suffer the guilt and judgment of God. That's the reason why Jesus came. In 2 Corinthians 5, 21, Paul says this in a more provocative way. He says, God made him who had no sin to be sin for us, so that in him we might become the righteousness of God. Of course, we're never told about the torment that he must have experienced spiritually on our behalf, taking the punishment of God himself on. I speculate that part of the reason why God chose the crucifixion was that he wanted a physical representation of the incredible horror that he was experiencing spiritually on our behalf. We're told in verse 28 and 29, later, knowing that all was now completed and so that the scripture would be fulfilled, Jesus said, "I'm thirsty." A jar of wine and vinegar was there, so they soaked the sponge in it, put the sponge on the stalk of the hyssop plant, and lifted it up to Jesus' lips. It's interesting that hyssop was used, the same sort of branch that was used in the Passover to dip the blood of the innocent lamb and smear it onto the doorpost to indicate that an innocent sacrifice had taken place for that household. And in verse 30, we're told finally, when he had received the drink, Jesus said, "It is finished." And with that, he bowed his head and gave up his spirit. This term, "it is finished," in Greek is the word tetelestai, paid in full. At that moment, Jesus paid for all the sins of the entire human race. God the Father took all of the selfishness, all of the evil, all of the injustice, all of the wrongdoing in the entire universe that was, and the judgment associated with it, and poured it out onto his Son. And it's really, I think, difficult to even imagine what that looked like for God the Father to take all of that fury and anger toward the injustice in the world and concentrating it at one time. I made a video that I feel like might kind of help us understand this.
Are you hungry? Are you sick? Are you begging for
God took all of those scenes, all of those images, and he, in his anger, in his moral indignation, in his fury, in his rage, at that moment decided at one moment that he was going to pour it out on his Son. He did that for each and every one of us. And once that happened, he said, "It's finished. It's all paid." We're told at that moment when he yelled, "It is finished," he bowed down his head and gave up his spirit. Let's draw some points of application. The first thing to realize is that Jesus came to die for all people, even those people who crucified him. We're told that as he was being crucified and the guards were mocking him, that he prayed to the Father, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." Even the guards who were driving spikes into his arms, the ones perpetrating this incredible crime against the God of the universe, he still prays for them, "Father, forgive them." He died for the guards who were killing him. You know, some people feel like, I just don't think that God can forgive me for all the things I've ever done wrong. Well, if he could forgive those guards, if he could forgive Pilate, if he could die for all of those guys, certainly what you have done is nothing in comparison. What Jesus did on the cross is adequate even for you. In this famous painting by Rembrandt called The Raising of the Cross, it depicts Jesus being stood up on the cross and the Roman guards taking a hand and pulling him up. And what's very interesting is that right there we have a self-portrait of Rembrandt there, depicting himself taking a hand in crucifying Jesus. Jesus not only died for you, you took a hand in killing the Son of God. He died for me, and I took a hand in killing the Son of God. And so really, one of the things that we need to realize is that we have a certificate of debt that needs to be paid. All of us, each and every one. And the question is, are you going to have it nailed to the cross? Are you going to receive the forgiveness that Jesus purchased with his life? Or the question is, are you going to pay for it yourself? Jesus did all the work to take the fury and all of the wrath that God rightfully should pour out on each and every one of us. He took that upon himself. But God's not going to force that on you. If you decide, I don't want that gift, then what God says, then you're going to have to pay for it yourself. Jesus, we thank you that you are willing to bear our guilt. We thank you that you love us so much that you went to this horrific extent to purchase us back to you. Lord, I just pray that as we, as believers, just reflect on this, that we would just be moved by the cross. I pray that we would be moved by how much you love us. I pray that we would be moved by how just you are as well, Lord, that the cross solves both the necessity for justice, but also your mercy for us as well. I pray specifically, Lord, for those of us who don't know you in a personal way, who may still be separated from you, who are carrying around a certificate of debt that has not been paid in full yet. I pray that they would just turn to you and receive the gift that you want to offer them. I pray that they would just have courage to do that. We thank you for anybody who did that. In Jesus' name, amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.